Thank you once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I am Harry Brady. This is podcast number 203. To break the habit of a lifetime, I decided this week to not ramble on in my amateur psychology and lawyer status and bring in a real expert to discuss the incidents and events in Amsterdam, Defensive Behaviour Football Act, and all things policing in relation to football fans. I'm joined by Professor, oblique Dr. Clifford Stott, who provides us with a fantastic insight into the matter. So this is me, Harry Brady, and this is him, Clifford Stott. I am joined by Mr. Clifford Stott. I hesitated there because I'm not sure whether you're a doctor, professor, or a mister.
And I'm both a doctor and a professor.
Oh, goodness me. I now feel nervous. As one of my employers used to say, he had RBAC after his name, Ready Break Art Competition was the total sum of his qualifications. So you are the Principal Research Fellow in Security and Justice in the Research Group and Visiting Professor, University of Leeds.
That's it, yeah. Yeah, I'm based at the University of Leeds.
Expertise on crowds, riots, psychology, hooliganism and policing.
That's right. My background is as a crowd psychologist, but for the past 15 years, most of the work that I've been doing is studying the policing of football crowds, and I'm widely considered to be Europe, if not the world's leading academic authority on the relationship between crowd psychology and public order policing in that domain.
Excellent. So you're just the man to speak to with us in Scotland, having had the recent changes for the Offensive Behaviour Football Act, and specifically for the Celtic supporters in the last month, where we have seen very contrasting policing strategies to high-profile football in relation to the Ajax game in Glasgow and the Ajax-Celtic game in Amsterdam. Before we go into that, you talked about the psychology of crowds and policing of that. I've always felt it a bit odd that policing of football seems to be so different to the policing of every other social activity I could get involved in. Do you mind giving a wee bit of background into why we have the biggest example I always give is nowhere else in my life do I have to stand for a minute's silence for things all the time, but I do it at the football.
Well, I think obviously football crowds have a history, and football crowd behaviour has a history of being problematic from the authorities' point of view. I think we only have to look back to the 1970s in particular to see those, what we might consider to be dark days. But yeah, I think that it's important to reconfigure our understanding of why violence and conflict happen in football crowds and football crowd events. And traditionally, we tended to understand that issue in terms of hooligans and hooliganism. And my work is very much about trying to shift the emphasis from that towards an understanding of these incidents of violence as an outcome of crowd psychology and behaviour, and in particular, crowd management practices. So when we study the major riots involving England fans, for example, travelling abroad to international competition, primarily from late 1980s onwards, we see a whole history of violence-related incidents, some of which have been catastrophic. Heysel would be an obvious example, but there are many, many examples of serious and extreme incidents of wide-scale violence. But where we look at those incidents, it's completely wrong to understand them simply in terms of the hooligan and hooliganism.
Yep.
Because they were essentially an outcome of crowd management practices, and in particular very poor crowd management practices in relationship to events like Heysel. For example, you cannot understand why Heysel happened without taking into account the stadium infrastructure, the very poor stadium infrastructure, the very poor levels of international police cooperation, the practices of the police on the day, the interaction between those features in relationship to the behaviour of fans. And only when you look at it in that kind of holistic way can you understand why Heysel happened. And if we try to locate the analysis and the blame for that act, that incident, in just one of those parties in isolation from the other, we're never going to understand it. And it opens up a whole series of questions as well. If we're never going to understand it in that way, why is it that we consistently focus the analysis on just fans themselves and consistently avoid asking these very, very important questions about the responsibility of others within the framework of these events?
It's interesting you say that because I joked about my qualifications. Actually, one of the things I did do was my dissertation at university was in relation to football supporters and members, and obviously covered at length. This was in the early 90s, so it was just after the Taylor Report.
Yeah.
One of the things that struck me about the Taylor Report was, as you'll know, Hillsborough was, and anybody obviously connected with Scottish football knows, with the Ibrox disaster just 20 years earlier, Hillsborough was not an isolated football disaster incident. And the immediate response in relation to safety was bringing in All-Seater Stadium. And in the talk now about standing sections, what seems to be forgotten, but also Hillsborough was on the back of, and the Taylor Report was on the back of, the trouble at football in the 1980s. So it was as much about controlling people.
Sure, sure. I mean, I think Hillsborough is, again, another really good example of how we need to understand how such disasters come about and the catalogue of disasters that has flowed from the decades of our establishment, if you like, failing to acknowledge the underlying issues, the underlying responses. Now, if we just simply focus on the Taylor Report, it's very clear that one of the dominant stories that remains from the Taylor Report is the issue of standing, as if standing was a solution. But the Taylor Report never looked at standing as a solution. It never saw standing as an isolated issue in relationship to a multitude of other issues in terms of stadium management. And those other issues are about licensing, they're about proper facilities, proper safety analysis and proper safety evaluation of a stadium to make sure it is fit for purpose. We've seen now safety advisory groups. We see stadium managers who are licensed and hold the license, the safety certificate, and only when that safety certificate, which is reviewed on a regular basis, is held by a stadium, can an event be hosted at that stadium. Now, those issues have been driven into the infrastructure of hosting football events to make the hosting of football events now fundamentally different from how they were hosted back in the days of the disaster of Hillsborough. But you're absolutely right, Brian. Of course, the other dimension to that is that one can read Hillsborough as an outcome of the fear of hooliganism by penning people into those terraces, by fearing the crowd, by practices that flow from the fear of hooliganism on the part of the police, all culminate in a situation where that stadium was so unsafe, it was lethal. Now, we can't really look at today's stadia, I don't think, in the same way. I think if you look now at Ibrox and Celtic Park, they are fundamentally modern stadia. They're fundamentally different places to the places where these disasters have occurred in the past. And so too, in a sense, is the football crowd. Football stadia now are in the modern era, and we need to modernise the way that we think about crowd management and responding to the issue of threats to so-called public order. In the UK, in England, that's predominantly around the issue of violence. Mm-hmm. And in Scotland at the moment, as you pointed out earlier, the primary concern is not so much violence, but more about what's termed offensive behaviour, but what we all understand is in terms of the underlying issues of sectarianism.
Yeah, and you talked about control, and that's one of the things that's interesting for me as a football fan who's gone in lots of different places all over the world. I definitely see, even between England and Scotland, I see a different attitude to policing of football supporters. Much as I may criticise Police Scotland, I have in general, and I say in general, felt safer going to Celtic games anywhere in Scotland than anywhere else in the rest of Europe that I've gone.
My experience of policing football in Scotland, I've been working in relationship to policing football in Scotland for well over 6 or 7 years now, and I had a relationship with the College of Policing for many years. My position, you've got it good in Scotland. You might be experiencing difficulties at the moment, but in general terms, the approach to policing football crowds in Scotland is very, very good. And that's primarily, I think, because it's embedded in a particular model of policing that is about policing from within the community. I mean, when was the last time you saw police support units, you know, riot police at Celtic Park? I mean, they're a rarity in Strathclyde.
Well, I mean, this is part of which I'll get onto in a minute, but part of my issue with the Ajax, visiting Ajax fans, was it is the first time I can recall seeing violence of any scale other than two guys falling out over a spilled drink inside a ground in Scotland that I've seen personally this century. I remember going in when Celtic went to Seville, being quite taken aback at how geared up the police were in Lancashire for when Celtic played Blackburn.
Yeah, there is a great deal of variability, and I think this is part of the problem. I think that where we look at policing in different parts of this country, there are major differences. You could go to one football ground and be treated in one way, and go to a different football ground only a few miles away and be treated in a completely different way. And there is a need here to create consistency. And then when we feed that back into the growing number of situations where fans experience policing abroad because of the Champions League and Europa League, there is a massive need to create consistency across the European Union in terms of how football crowds are policed. And the particular challenge there is that you're going into another country where you are going to meet policing practices that are, at some level, fundamentally different to the ones that you meet in the home context. And in many circumstances, those travelling football fans will not be aware of how the local police police and will expect a form of policing similar to that which they receive in their home stadium, and don't really understand why those changes come about. And that dynamic itself can create substantial conflict.
Well, I was going to go over a couple of things in relation to offensive behaviour and then talk about Amsterdam, but I'll talk about Amsterdam now since we're talking about overseas policing. One of the things that struck me, particularly watching video of English fans in the late 80s, early 90s, I always got the impression that part of the problem was when they went on holiday to Spain and behaved in a certain fashion, they got away with it. And when they went on holiday with a football club or the national team and behaved in the same way, and I say this with English parents before, this sort of jingoistic, we are England and we won the war mentality. Part of the problem seemed to be that they weren't expecting to be treated any differently to what they would do for a week's holiday in Spain.
Well, OK, we're walking into a minefield here now, aren't we? I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of what we might call stereotypes around the nature of the behaviour of English fans abroad. Let me give you an example from the late 90s, where both Scotland and England were playing in the 1998 World Cup finals in France.
Yeah.
And I went to watch England's opening game in Marseille. And there were substantial numbers of riots that grew up in the 2 or 3 days surrounding that match that were an outcome of conflicts between an element of the English support and local North African youths that grew into a major conflagration between the two sets of fans as a function of ordinary English fans getting attacked simply for being in Marseille and supporting England, for being English. And where you look at the situation there, what were those England fans doing? Well, yeah, of course, a few of them were behaving in this jingoistic way, but the majority of English fans were doing what football fans do when they go abroad, which is to just drink and be loud and boisterous and to hang out in large groups celebrating their football team. Now, after Marseille, we drove directly to Bordeaux to observe the policing of Scotland games, and it was like going into a different world. Apart from the fact that when I arrived in central Bordeaux, outside one of the Irish pubs, there was a group of about 150 Scotland fans. Put it bluntly, they were mindlessly drunk.
Yep.
And they were sat in front of this pub, blocking the road. Now, Bordeaux has a one-way system.
I've been there, yeah. Been there myself.
They were blocking the one-way system, and there was this traffic jam, as far as the eye could see, down the boulevard. And these irate French drivers were getting out and going up to the Scotland fans. And so the Scotland fans were just basically telling them to calm down and piss off, basically. And what we see there is it not a contrast in the behaviour of the fans, because they're doing pretty much what England fans do. It's a contrast in the interpretation by the authorities of that behaviour. So the very same behaviour, if it had been England fans, I'm absolutely convinced would have been seen as hooliganism. And as a function of that, there would have been a police intervention, and that police intervention would have been with force to disperse that crowd from the road. Now, because there were Scotland fans, that intervention didn't take place, because primarily it wasn't seen as hooliganism. It was seen as, jolly Scots, a bit carnivalesque. So the interpretations of the behaviour are fundamentally different. And I don't believe that there is that much of a difference, if at all, between the behaviour of the two sets of fans in terms of the general norms that they display when they go abroad. And there is a tendency to view English fans as boorish and confrontational and so on. But that doesn't bear up to scrutiny. It doesn't really reflect what goes on.
And I'm interested that you've used that example, because if we look at Amsterdam, one of the questions I was going to ask is twofold. How much two-way dialogue is there between the police forces about this is what's about to land on your doorstep? And the reason I ask that, because I've been going abroad watching Celtic for 20 years on and off. And I'm a non-drinker. So I look in and see lots of guys who go across to enjoy being in the city they're visiting, get a good bevy inside them, go to the game or watch the game on the pub and just sing Celtic songs and then go home. And I get the impression that's what was happening in Amsterdam, but the Dutch police looked at it differently.
I wouldn't disagree with you. I think the way in which we need to understand what went on in Amsterdam reflects the way in which I think we need to understand the problem in general, that this is a problem of crowd management, that there were certain failures on the part of the Amsterdam police authorities to police the risk, to understand the risk properly. And there are lots of important questions about why those failures came about, the relationship between the Scottish police and the Dutch police, what kind of information was being given to the Dutch police. Was it, for example, a case where the information provided to the Dutch police was more about travelling so-called risk fans among the Celtic contingency than it was about the need for a certain policing approach towards Celtic fans in general? There's an issue there about why it was that there wasn't a fan park set aside in an area that was more conducive to the maintenance of the safety of those thousands of ticketless fans that were inevitably going to descend into Amsterdam on that day. There is, a model that Celtic, Ronnie Hawthorne from Celtic, has a big role internationally in advising on approaches to the management of the Celtic fan base, and he draws his recommendations from your experiences in Barcelona, mm-hmm. where they developed a fan park and lots of facilities there, including a massive paella and so on. And I think you probably would have been at that fixture.
Yeah.
And it was very effective at creating a very positive, welcoming atmosphere within which it becomes possible to manage the Celtic fans without the use of riot police, without the threat of these kinds of escalations from taking place. I was left asking questions, why didn't that take place? What was it that led the Amsterdam authorities to feel that they didn't need to adopt that model? Why did the Amsterdam authorities decide that they were going to do it in a different way to international good practice? Then you've got all sorts of other problems about the failure to assess the risk. You know, you've got a situation where you've got Ajax fans that go across to Glasgow. There's substantial conflict in and outside the stadium surrounding that fixture, such that UEFA actually fine the club for failing to control their fans. Mm-hmm. There's then the attack on the Tuesday evening on the Old Sailor in the Red Light District, on that bar where Celtic fans were. It was very easy to understand that there was the potential for that kind of escalation, that kind of attack to occur the following day. And one of the things that we try to teach police in terms of the framework of policing these kinds of fixtures is a concept called dynamic risk assessment. And that means that you're constantly trying to assess whether the risk changes from one moment to the other. So if we get to the point where you've got, 12,000 Celtic fans gathered in Dam Square after all the preceding events, and they haven't changed their risk assessment to recognise the threats that could be posed by attacks from Ajax hooligans, there is a massive failure on the part of the Amsterdam authorities in their risk assessment. That much is obvious. And then with the cross-cultural issue that we were talking about earlier on, you throw into that mix an undercover or plainclothes arrest squad, mm-hmm. you are increasing the risk even further. And let's understand that in the Netherlands, these arrest squads have been around for decades, and they work at every kind of high-risk crowd event. And I've seen them work very, very effectively in the past. I've seen them de-escalate situations with great effect when they are used appropriately. But in this circumstance, we see a situation where they have been used in a way where all the evidence suggests that the fans that were involved in confrontation with them didn't understand them as cops at all and just saw them as local hooligans attacking their comrades, if you like.
Yeah.
That's a situation that we've seen elsewhere. I remember doing planning I was involved in the security planning for the European Championships in Portugal in 2004. And we had a situation in Faro, the city where England were playing a friendly before the tournament, and had exactly the same thing. We had a group of 20 plainclothes Portuguese police officers who English fans thought were a group coming to attack them, to size them up.
Mm-hmm.
And that developed into a conflict precisely because of that misinterpretation, which we should add is increased in its likelihood precisely because you're dealing with crowds that are heavily in drink.
Yeah.
So lots and lots of drunk people. Their judgments are not always effective at that particular point in time. And the police, in a sense, have a responsibility to understand that and to map what they do into a situation that reduces the likelihood of disorder, not increases it. And what we've seen here is a failure in that respect on a whole series of different levels.
So what would be the normal strategy? You say these squads have been around for 10, 20 years. What's their normal strategy? Because it just seems to me that they just randomly piled into Celtic supporters and picked out whoever was unlucky enough to be straggling or to decide to not run away and cower.
Yeah, well, the normal strategy, I've seen them work in partnership with the riot control units, so the guys in uniform with the batons and the shields and so on. And where I've seen them work, they work in a situation where there is an already hostile crowd. And they try to identify people in the crowd who are openly and actively seeking to create confrontation and move through the crowd to take those people away. They generally run out of the crowd, grab the individual in question, and then run through police lines with that individual.
Mm-hmm.
So once they've got that individual, if they've done their work properly, then it should de-escalate the problem, which where I've seen it work, that has been the case. It was an England game where some ticketless fans had got into the stadium and opened one of the exit gates to try and let other ticketless fans in. And that had led to a confrontation in the context where the majority of people there were legitimate ticket holders. And the police worked in a particular way to draw out those that were seeking conflict from the crowd, and then they were taken away by these arrest squads. The police withdrew and the situation calmed. Now, had they not been in operation, there's questions there about whether the police would have, in the end, dispersed the entire crowd from that vicinity. And given that the vast majority were legitimate ticket holders, it almost certainly would have led to an escalation that would have been classified as a riot.
Now, so that's the Dutch way of dealing with it. The complete opposite in Glasgow. You touched on, I mean, I genuinely have never seen so many blue flashing lights prior to a Celtic game in decades as there was prior to the Celtic Ajax game in Glasgow. They picked up seats and chucked them and threw them, and, you know, there's reports of, right next to a family section, there's reports of kids going home at half-time because they've been hit by coins, and Police Scotland arrested nobody. So why do our police have such a completely different attitude? Because I don't even think we've got any, well, you'll tell me whether we've even got any policy for having snatch squads in that situation. Our police have always talked about it's more dangerous to intervene in a crowd than it is to just corral them and move them on and deal with them later.
Well, it's difficult to talk in generalities, I think. I mean, it does sound a shame that we've had a situation where young children have been injured and so on, and there has been no intervention to try and address that. But I mean, all interventions should be risk assessed, and under certain circumstances, of course, it's the case that police are not going to intervene because those interventions can escalate the problem, and that's the bottom line. You can't get away from that reality. But it's a question of understanding how policing operations come about and how, as a consequence, they vary from one place to another. I mean, the policing operation in Glasgow would have been headed up by Police Scotland, by presumably a chief superintendent or above, who would have made the primary decisions about what the goals, the strategy of the police was, and then senior commanders would have then implemented that strategy. So it's really their shout, how they do it. And it's up to them how they do it. And then when you go abroad and you go to Amsterdam, it's a different police force, a different commander, and it's up to them how to do it. And nobody can really tell them how to do it. It's their job, and that's what they're there to do and to make decisions about. So as a consequence, you get lots and lots of variation. And also, as a consequence, it's very difficult to create uniformity, because you can't, as a police force, go abroad and say, listen, Gov, you know, I know you normally police it this way, but with our lot, if you police them like that, it's going to kick off. Because generally what happens is that they will ignore that advice, yep, and police it in the way that they normally police it, as a function of their standard practices. And on many, many occasions, what we see is that those standard practices create more risk, create disorder more than they control it. And that is the real tragedy of all of this, is that within this framework, we've got situations where people's lives are ultimately torn apart. I mean, you know, even I've got to look to these guys who've been up before the courts in Amsterdam. I mean, I don't hold out much hope that they are going to have those convictions overturned. And the consequence is that they're almost certainly going to end up in prison and have a criminal record as a function of going to a football match. And for me, that's the biggest tragedy of all.
And that's one of the things that struck me just in this half hour that we've been speaking. Your point that this is a well-accepted practice in Amsterdam with these plainclothes squads. You're then saying you're asking the courts to then accept that something which is a regular occurrence is wrong. And that's going to be just from everything you've said, I am, my hope for the guys in the Dutch courts has just diminished.
Well, there's no getting away from it. At the end of the day, they assaulted police officers.
Yeah,
and, you know, that's what happened. As a function of all of these failures, it ended up in a situation where a group of young men decided to make a particular set of decisions that culminated in them in a situation where they're convicted of assaulting these police officers. And we also have to understand that where you're in these kinds of high-profile riots, the courts will act in a particular way that exercises what is widely understood to be justice within the framework of a set of interests.
Yeah.
And it would be very, very unusual indeed for a high-profile trial like that to come down on the side of those fans who've been convicted, because the only interpretation that would subsequently be would be that the police case was fundamentally flawed, and it would be, you know, a major political snub to the Amsterdam Police Department. Now, are we going to see that? I don't think so.
And I suppose, getting back to the difference in style of policing, we are used to a certain style of policing in the UK, as we've touched on. And I think the agitation with the fact that not a single Ajax fan was arrested for violent acts is the slight change in policing that we've seen in Scotland since the Offensive Behaviour of Football Act came out, where there's been much more videoing of football supporters, dawn raids at people's houses for people being arrested for singing something that's termed by the police to be offensive. And I think set in the context of that, I think that's where the difficulty of accepting the different policing style has also come in.
Well, you've got a changing situation in Scotland for sure.
And one of the things that I find interesting is, at the same time as we've had the change in style in policing because of the Offensive Behaviour Act, there's been a lot more organising and corralling of the way that English football supporters have been having to go to and from games. And certainly something that, although our supporters complain when a bus to Dingwall gets pulled over at Perth, there's been far more severe policing of football supporters happening in England. And a lot of people listening to this might not be aware of some of those things.
Well, you say that, but I don't think things have particularly changed. I mean, the policing approach in England is very varied. I mean, you've got to bear in mind the number of police forces that we have in England and Wales, and each of those police forces will go about policing its football venues in sometimes very, very different ways. And
I think it's specifically of the bubbles where supporters have to go to a central point to then be escorted to a ground and back, that we just don't experience here.
Yet.
Could you see that coming?
You haven't experienced it yet. but you, I think, again, you know, it's important to look at, you know, when we talk about policing of football crowds, in policing terminology, we're talking about public order policing. Now, it's important to recognise that there isn't really a football-specific approach to public order policing. It's just public order policing. And particularly in England and Wales, cops don't get trained in policing football so much, per se. They just have a general approach. So they're policing training for policing public order will be as much about policing the 2011 riots as it will be about policing a ticket queue at Highbury or, you know, at the Emirates, yep. Sorry. So we've got to understand that the way in which police crowds is actually quite limited. It focuses very much on the use of force, and it's oriented towards controlling space and controlling movement through space. And it will do that either by containment, what we call bubbling or kettling, or dispersal, driving into a crowd to disperse people and move people on, or arrest. And to be honest, that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
Arrest, dispersal, containment. And that's how public order policing works in general. So if you're in a situation where you perceive that a crowd, a group, poses a threat to public order, of course, the normal response is to try and contain that. And you contain it by corralling it, and then you seek to maintain control by escorting, and then you'll generally put it into a football stadium, relax for a bit for 90 minutes while the game's on, and then that risk will come out again, and you try to deal with it either by dispersal or containment, getting them and putting them back on the train and gone. And that's pretty much how it works. There's no sophistication to it. It's not conspiratorial. It's just a phenomena that grows out of how the police think about managing crowds.
So you wouldn't be surprised if we had it coming for big games.
You've got a different history in Scotland about your policing. And this is what I think, actually, for me, is the single biggest tragedy of all of this is where you were actually going. Because Scotland, I think, certainly from around about 2005 through to around about 2009, was leading the way in terms of football policing. You didn't deploy, Strathclyde Police, for example, didn't deploy riot police, PSUs, police support units, we call them, at football matches. You had a police force that was committed to maintaining a particular orientation that was, I think, community-centred and community-focused. You'd had a group of commanders there. There was particularly, I think it's in G Division, mm-hmm. You had a group of commanders. There's a guy called Kenny Scott and a guy called Robin Howe. And they were very, very forward-thinking, progressive commanders who were interested in evolving the situation. And this was particularly the case in relationship to sectarianism. And they had made major inroads into transforming and supporting the transformation of Scottish football fan culture, in particular around the Old Firm. I remember just before he retired, Robin Howe was working to move towards a situation where he removed segregation from cup finals between the Old Firm at be Hampden Park, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, Hampden Park. So he'd done some work previously where there was a lot of seats were given over to create a segregation zone when the Old Firm played their finals.
Yep.
So he opened up negotiation with some of the organised fan groups in both communities and made an agreement with them that they would open up access to those tickets, provided that the fan groups would guarantee that there would be no disorder, no confrontation around those particular areas. And on the day that they did it, what happened was that the fans that populated that area turned up in shirt and ties. And it was a major achievement. It was a major breakthrough in terms of where they were going. And his intention was to take it to the next step and get rid of segregation altogether. And it strikes me that given the progress that they were making, we get to a situation where suddenly the Offensive Behaviour Act is on the table. And one is left wondering why it was seen as necessary to implement that act, why it was that the act was then so vociferously accepted and has driven forward in terms of a particular policing approach, which is, as I'm sure you're aware, very much centred on this unit, I think it's referred to as the focus unit.
Yep.
And there is a particular approach that I think is being developed there. And correspondingly, what's I find interesting is two things. First, I used to teach on the Football Match Commanders course, and Scotland was unique in this respect of having, from 2005 onwards, a course designed specifically for match commanders that was compulsory for all match commanders, all public order commanders who would police football in Scotland. And Kenny Scott and Robin Howe were integral to that course, and they invited me to lecture on it and so on. And that ran for many years. But that course is gone now. So corresponding with the implementation of the Act, that course no longer exists. Also, I did a bid. Running alongside the legislation, the Offensive Behaviour Act, is a clause that means that they have to conduct an evaluation to present to Parliament in 2015.
Right.
I made a bid for that piece of work. It was a very, very good bid, and it drew on my expertise. It brought in one of Europe's leading human rights lawyers, who was involved in the transformation of the RUC to the PSNI, and also was behind the Adapting to Protest Review, the governmental inquiry, or the HMRC inquiry into the death of Ian Tomlinson. And she and I, along with a group of highly experienced police commanders from England, put together a package to investigate and evaluate the Offensive Behaviour Acts. We didn't get that contract.
Right.
And I was left wondering why, because it was a very, very good bid. And I don't think that the feedback was really reflective of what anything being wrong with our bid, but we didn't get it. And I wonder whether that was because there was a fear that our analysis would be critical of what the Act is doing and how the Act functions. And I think the Act, it remains to be seen, but I think looking at the evidence, the Act is potentially highly counterproductive, and it starts to go against some of the major inroads that police in Scotland had actually, I think, made in terms of addressing the sectarian issue that have been almost reversed.
Well, from my own perspective, it seemed to have been what precipitated it was the famous game of shame that they referred to. Well, I was at that game, and I didn't know there was any issue until I got home and listened to the media talking about it on the radio. Mm. From my own perspective, there would have been better having an offensive behaviour in pubs in Lanarkshire and Ayrshire Act, because the problem appears to be not at the ground, but they brought in an act to deal with the problem at the ground. And then you're right, it seems to have driven a wedge, really creating a them and us culture between the younger supporters and the police. There's always going to be a them and us attitude between police forces and young people in society in general. This seems to have just exacerbated it. And then the other aspect of it is, this they wouldn't have known really, but right at a time when any of these issues would have been getting sorted, just because Celtic and Rangers were not playing each other in the same league, they've actually created an ongoing problem.
I tend to agree with you. I mean, it would have been fascinating to be able to study it on a week by week basis and look at what was going on, what was happening in terms of the police acting in relationship to this act, and to study, you know, its impact and outcomes. But I tend to think that you're absolutely right, that at face value what appears to be going on here is that it seems to be entrenching an antagonism towards the police and entrenching a polarised identity among Celtic fans who see themselves as being victimised. Now, if that's the case, do we not think it's ironic that the very function of legislation to address sectarianism is to address the historical repression of Catholic communities in Scotland?
Well,
and yet under this legislation, we're seeing a situation where that very community sees itself as under attack from the state.
I mean, I mentioned earlier about my parents being English. One of their first experiences of the problems of the Glasgow area in terms of sectarianism was my dad cutting his grass and a man coming to the door and asking him if he'd sign a petition against a Catholic school coming into the area. Now, this is in the last 40 years, because I was alive. And because we all know that the Catholics live in poorer areas, I was fortunate to live in a nice place. The Catholics live in poorer areas and they'll be busting them in and they'll be running amok through the gardens. Well, my dad naturally told him where to go. But if you have that in the last 40 years that existed in Scotland, then as someone who's a bit detached because my parents are English, I do sometimes think that Scotland's only way of dealing with the fact that we have a sectarian problem is to turn around and say they are two sides of the same coin, so we have to find a way of dealing with them equally, because we can't possibly have a situation where one side gets more criticism than the other. And that's what the legislation looks like, by instead of, as you said, it's to deal with the sectarian issue, but they've had to widen its definition to offensive to make it more encompassing. And that's the perception of a lot of people.
Well, I think as well it's important to recognise a couple of things. The first is that parallel to the implementation of the Offensive Behaviour Act in Scotland, the government in England is considering removing the offensive component from the Section 5 of our 1986 Public Order Act. And the reason that they're considering getting rid of that element of Section 5, and I think it is actually going to go, is that actually the European Convention of Human Rights allows us to be offensive. We have the freedom of expression, yep. And that expression has a freedom even if other people find it offensive. So how can we have a situation where a government imposes a law that says it's wrong to be offensive when the Human Rights Act protects your right to be offensive? So, I mean, it strikes me as immediately contradictory at that level. And then when you drill down into the detail of this legislation, there is the ambiguity about what actually constitutes offensive behaviour. And the bottom line is that it's arbitrary. And the reason it's arbitrary is that what it's doing is creating the opportunity for its discretionary imposition by police in particular circumstances. And inevitably what that means is, in the context of a football crowd, is that specific individuals are being hauled out and criminalised as a function of this act, and criminalised in a way that feeds into a perception that they have been unjustly and unfairly treated, which feeds into an increased polarisation between those communities and the police, and therefore, I would argue, increased radicalisation, increased likelihood of problems. Now, if we take all of that into account and compare it with the work that I've been doing around trying to produce cultural change and manage problems of disorder among football fans, it goes counter to everything that my research and theory suggests we should do if we want to drive into this problem in a long-lasting and meaningful way. Because the only way that we're going to bring about that kind of cultural change in these communities is with the communities themselves. And if we alienate those communities and drive them away, they are going to be less likely to join us in a common attempt to try and bring about a satisfactory resolution to this problem over the longer term.
And, of course, the problem is, from our perspective as football supporters, how can you, when politicians have been so vociferous in pushing through a piece of legislation against a lot of advice, how do you get them to change their mind and go back on it? Because politicians don't like abrupt about faces.
Well, I think it's in part the danger of this particular piece of work about the evaluation is that it's going to be used to keep the legislation in place, even in the face of vociferous opposition to it. I think you're absolutely right that it is a political issue, but it doesn't detract from the realities of what we need to face up to in terms of crowd management. I could only hope that the organisation that did get this contract does a good piece of work, and that we do have an empirical case on the table that allows the politicians the opportunity to make that about face without losing face. But potentially we could be in a fundamentally different situation by the time that comes about anyway, because you could be ebbing towards your own independence. And
that
I think you've got a whole series of political issues ahead of you as a country that push this one into lesser significance, should we say, for the wider community, if not for yourselves. But I also think it's important to start talking about the generalities here, because one of the things I noticed is that, the divide between yourselves and Rangers is acute.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes both ways.
Yeah.
And it's such a tragedy, because I looked at some of the tweets around Rangers fans talking about these guys getting convicted in Amsterdam that were expressing their glee at this fact, and it was good to see these Celtic fans hauled across the courts and so on and so forth. But at the same time, Rangers fans back in Manchester had a very similar experience, and just to demonstrate that the same issues applied to them in Manchester. You cannot understand how and why the riot involving Rangers fans in Manchester came about without taking into account these wider issues about police intervention and police practice and police handling of the crowd, particularly in the fan park in Piccadilly Gardens when the screen went down and the police decided to intervene with force. And the difficulty is here is that Scottish football fans can't unite around issues that affect them in common. So divided are you as a community that you are so disempowered to confront the fundamental realities of the situation that you find yourselves in. And the tragedy will remain until, in my view, as a community of football fans, you can come together to confront your common concerns.
And my concern is the one place I want to be whenever we get round to playing whatever Rangers get back into the Premier League, the one place I want to be is a million miles away from Glasgow whenever Celtic play Rangers. Because I think that's going to be a horrible game. And that's one of the things that lots of people seem to... The press keep talking about Celtic and Rangers missing each other and blah, blah, blah. I don't. And I don't miss that game, and it's going to be a pretty unpleasant experience, that game. And so your point about uniting, and I'm sure you're right, getting back to my continual bugbear that football is in the 21st century, has late 20th century facilities and mid 20th century customer service, including policing style. That can only be resolved if all the football supporters together say, we're not going to take this anymore.
20th century policing and 16th century religious attitudes. of course, it exposes the more generic problem in Scottish football. It's not a problem simply of Scottish football. It's a broader tension within our community on a broader level, not just Scotland, but also Northern Ireland and so on. And we still have features of it down here in England. I mean, I've seen orange marches here in Liverpool.
Yeah, and that's one of my biggest issue with it being the Offensive Behaviour at Football Act, is this concept that the ills of society can all be dealt with if you just deal with that dirty down market game of football.
Well, exactly. It's a symptom rather than a cause. And what we see going on in the context of football stadia in Glasgow around the Old Firm are a reflection of broader social tensions that need to be addressed at a cultural level. And the danger is, of course, by intervening in the football context in the way in which this act does, there is a very real tension that emerges that starts to encroach upon the legitimacy of people's identity expression. So when does it become... What's the difference between celebrating your history as a community and being offensive? Where does that line get drawn? And if that line gets drawn by the authorities in an inappropriate place, is there not then a danger that what will happen is that the authorities will be seen to be denying people the rights of their freedom of expression, the right of their own identity? And that, I think, is more likely to lead to circumstances where that community will seek to reassert its identity in various different places, both inside and outside of football, in a way that will recapitulate the problem. And that's the tragedy of all of this, is that actually a great deal of progress was made between 2005 and 2009, 2010 in this respect. And what we appear to be looking at is a turning around of that progress, and off we're trotting in a what I think is quite a reactionary direction in terms of the policing that begins to undermine the potential for future progress.
Well, I've just noticed that you promised me half an hour of your time and you've given me 55 minutes.
Yeah, well, you can never shut me up when you get here.
So I literally could stay on here until it's currently 3:45. I could stay on here until 3:45 tomorrow going through this, but I'm conscious of the fact you've been very generous with your time.
Okay, it's a pleasure.
Okay, so thanks very much. And your Twitter is at Clifford Stott.
Yes.
So I would urge anybody listening to this podcast with an interest in how they are managed at police to get following you on Twitter, because it's very interesting. I hope you found that as interesting as I did. If you're interested in following and getting more from Dr. Bleep Professor Clifford Stott, you can follow him on Twitter. As I said, it is at CLIFFORDSTOTT. Someone else you might want to follow on Twitter would be at Jeff Pearson. That's GEOFF_PEARSON. And I would also look at FFS_FairCop. There are obviously many others on Twitter that are excellent for this type of thing. But for an external viewpoint, those three would be good for starters. Any other suggestions you might have that I'm unaware of? Twitter's a big place. Tweet now. After you've listened to this, and I'll retweet it. Hope you enjoyed, and I hope you enjoy the silences. Speak to you next time. Cheers. Thanks.
Scottish rain.